This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The Lindsay Clancy trial are more than a week now into testimony at Plymouth Superior Court. The prosecution has spent every one of those days building basically the same argument. If you're sitting there going, didn't we argue this yesterday? You're not alone. She was deliberate. She was meticulous. She planned it. But after a week of their own witnesses on the stand, some of what the jury is hearing sounds a lot more like the defense's case than the prosecution's. Eric Faddis is a defense attorney, former prosecutor, and he is with us to help us break down where this case is at, where this case is going now that we're thus far into it. Robin is away today, but he'll be back on Monday. Eric, let's start here. The prosecution obviously has built their entire first week around the one image of January 24th, 2023. Lindsay Clancy built a snowman with her kids. She texted photos to Patrick. He told the jury she was having one of her best days. She placed a takeout order, picked up medicine at CVS. He did. And then a couple hours later, all three of the kids were dead. Prosecution wants you to believe it was the best day ever. They keep going, it was the best day. Because she was, and then she planned to kill her kids. That she was planning to kill her kids. And that was what part of made it the best day. That while she's building the snowman, she's sitting there thinking, gee, I can't wait for those exercise bands. Despite begging for help from anyone who would actually listen. Isn't that the hardest part to sell to the jury? That she was suffering from psychosis, because it really kind of sounds like the actions of a person in the midst of a psychotic episode. If you're building a snowman with your kids and then you're killing them in the next breath, that sounds like psychosis to me. That doesn't sound like the best day ever. It doesn't feel like they're making their argument very strong to the jury. I don't know. That's my take. What's yours so far?
Yeah, Tony, the prosecution has done a great job so far at supporting the defense's case. That they started with Patrick Clancy, the husband. He was like the most sympathetic guy there is. Mm-hmm. Besides the children, he's the biggest victim there is in all of this. And he was almost every chance he could get making points that were helpful for the defense. And now that the prosecution has this kind of theory where they're like, hey, she was running these errands. She knew what she was doing. This was all on purpose and was going to crescendo into this like gleeful delight in the strangulation of her three children. It's just such a non sequitur. It goes so left that the jury is like, what? That story doesn't even logically follow.
I hope that's where they land with it. We obviously won't know till they go back there and start deliberating. Kevin Reddington stood up in front of the judge and told him his client does not contest the government's case in chief. She killed her kids. We know that. That has been established. Obviously, the prosecution wanted to get as much mileage out of that as they could because it's heartbreaking. It's horrible. But it's not up for debate. She killed the kids. The blood is hers. The exercise bands are the murder weapons. The DNA matches. He volunteered to save the prosecution from calling dozens of witnesses to prove chain of custody, which was going to be the next rabbit that they pulled out of their hat. The prosecution, if they wanted to win the case, would seemingly want this emotional, devastating testimony in front of the jury. But it's out now. It's not going to be there. Are they happy about that? I mean, who does this advantage more when you pull all of those pieces of devastating testimony out? And I guess my other question is the prosecution didn't seem all that like, you know, ready to fight to keep it in either.
Under these circumstances, sometimes the defense attorney seems like, oh, hey, we want to save the jury a bunch of time. I'm looking out for y'all. Like, this is, I want to make this easier on you guys. We're conceding this thing. And it looks like a really noble act. And perhaps it is in a sense, but also it is gaining them a tremendous benefit by not having to repeat some of the more potentially grisly and problematic details of the prosecution's case that would have been drilled into the jury's head over and over again. We're avoiding all of that. And so it not only does it look good to the jury, but tactically from defense standpoint, I think it's a super smart move.
I mean, it's a very smart move. Are you surprised at all that the judge was okay with pulling this out at this stage in the game? There was already planned for this to be a 6 to 8 week trial that was on the books. They were ready to go with it. We knew going in that that she killed the kids, that this was not really up for debate. I guess why the change of course now? Why does Reddington's argument suddenly land with the judge that we don't really need to go down this road? She's admitting to it. She has the whole time. Why do we keep pounding this into their minds? Is the judge just like, this is getting redundant and making the best decision for integrity of a trial, or what?
Perhaps. And I would have anticipated the prosecution would have challenged this measure a little bit more, because really the prosecution does have a right to put on their case within the lawful parameters of the rules of evidence and everything. But if they want to say, hey, you know, we appreciate the defense would stipulate to this, but we think the jury needs the full picture. We think they need the details. We think they need the perspective here that we're going to present. And so then you just sort of strengthen some of the points, you're bolstering some of your own points in going through that process. I thought the prosecution would push back more, in which case oftentimes the judge is like, hey, it'd be nice if the prosecution would agree, but they're allowed to put on their cases they want. We're going to let these witnesses do it. But the prosecution kind of didn't put up a big fight about it.
I'm kind of surprised by that. I am kind of surprised that the prosecution didn't put up more of a fight. I'm not accusing them of this, and this is just kind of pure conjecture question here, and not necessarily about this case specifically. But have you ever seen in your career as, you know, as a defense attorney, also as a prosecutor, in just witnessing many cases, do you ever see it where a prosecutor, you know, it's obviously their job to prosecute this case, where it kind of gets phoned in at a certain point, where maybe they're not really in it to win it. Maybe they don't really believe in what they've been assigned to prosecute, but it's their job. They have to go and prosecute it. And they pull back on certain things that they too think, yeah, this is getting kind of ridiculous. Do you think that could be going on here, or does that ever go on in cases where the prosecutor is like, yes, it is my job to toe this line, but I don't even really believe the line I'm towing.
Tony, it's like you've worked in a prosecutor's office before. That absolutely goes on all of the time. You know, publicly, they've got to put on this front, like, hey, we believe wholeheartedly in all these cases we prosecute, including this one. But internally, there could be some dissent. There could be some folks who are a little iffy on what the objectives of the office are and whether they pertain to this case. So certainly I've seen cases where a prosecutor, you know, sometimes their boss makes them. I'm not saying that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they don't necessarily agree with some of the directives they receive from the top. But it's a chain of command kind of thing in most prosecutors' offices. It's almost militaristic at times, in my experience. And so that happens.
Yeah, I mean, what is that like when you're in that sort of a situation where you I mean, everybody's human. Everybody has jobs to do. I mean, oftentimes you hear this argument against defense attorneys where how can you represent somebody like that? Because everybody deserves a defense. That's why we have defense attorneys. We'd be in a horrible state if they didn't exist, because not everybody is guilty. It's not often that it's talked about on the prosecutor end of these sort of things, but that's your job. I mean, you're working there for the government to prosecute a case. They say, here's the one you're going after. If you fundamentally disagree with it, do you have many outs? Do you ever like, I have fundamental reasons to disagree with this, and I'm not your person for this case? Or is it just sometimes, well, here's what's on your desk, make lemons out of lemonade?
Might depend on the boss, you know. I've worked in offices where if you voice some moral concern about a case, even if the boss doesn't agree with you, they might say, hey, I appreciate where you're at with that, and we're not going to make you do something that's against your conscience, and we disagree with you, and we'll put a different prosecutor on it. Sometimes that's how it works out. Sometimes it's like, hey, I don't think we should be doing this. I'm not sure this person is guilty. And the boss is like, you know, pipe down, you just kind of trudge ahead as a soldier out there. And those things happen all of the time. And those office dynamics creep into play as well. So, you know, not every prosecutor wholeheartedly believes in their case like they may present. Same with defense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you want, you know, if you're the boss and you're wanting to get a case prosecuted and you want to win your case, whoever you are putting onto the stage of the courtroom to fight the case, you want them to be in it to win it. You want them to believe in it, but sometimes you get the folks that aren't there, and then that ultimately, probably indirectly, gets communicated to a jury, and you don't always have the best of results as to where that would want to go. The toxicologists testify that every drug in Lindsay's system was at a therapeutic concentration. They're really focusing on the math here and not so much the mental end of it, meaning each one individually was within a prescribed range. Okay, great. That doesn't really tell us a whole hell of a lot. The one drug that was slightly elevated, Seroquel, still wasn't anywhere near a toxic level, but there is a woman who was on 13 different psychiatric medications here that we're talking about at the same time. The prosecution is saying, see, the drugs she was on were in range. They're not Tic Tacs. She wasn't taking the recommended dose of sugar for the day. These are powerful drugs that work differently with different people. This is not rocket science. This is just common understanding of how these sort of drugs work. The prosecution is essentially saying that all drugs work the same for everyone as long as they're in range. So it can't be the drugs that cause this. I mean, number one, it's nonsense. But even more, she had postpartum psychosis and bipolar. Even without the drugs, she could fall into a psychotic state. Why are they relying so heavily on the drug argument here when it really can very easily be debunked and fall flat, not even with conjecture, just with pure facts and how these things work?
Of course. You know, I think the prosecution's trying to say this wasn't crazy because she was being treated for crazy and the treatment appears within the therapeutic levels. So that can't be the reason. It had to be purposeful, knowing murder. But I think that rings a little hollow. Like, we all know, gosh, if you're not crazy before, if you're given a 13 drug cocktail, the chances that you are going to be at some point is substantially increased. Like, I just think all of that stuff going on neurochemically in your body, combined with the severe mental health issues of bipolar and postpartum psychosis, all of those together. And also what it looks like too, Tony, from the defense side, is that she's trying to address these things. She's not being reckless and flopping off and running in the middle of the highway or something. She's trying.
I don't know. Am I wrong for being surprised that their arguments on the prosecution side just seem to go completely against just basic understanding of how medications work? I mean, it's like they're asking the jury to live in a world that doesn't exist, in a land of make-believe on how cause and effects work with prescription medication, with psychosis. If you were to believe, I guess in the world of Massachusetts, that's a great place to have a child because postpartum psychosis doesn't exist, postpartum depression doesn't exist, none of these problems go into play, and mixing medications at different levels and all of that, they work like Tic Tacs. Everything just works great in Massachusetts, I guess, at least according to the prosecution.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I think that the higher ups in prosecution and law enforcement said, we have three dead children, and it wasn't an accident. They were strangled to death. There's got to be a crime in there. We're going to find it, and we're going to prosecute it. But as you go down that road and there are mental health evaluations, there are further details that are revealed. There are new things that come to light about a history of a person seeking help and experiencing problems, trying to contend with them. I think it really gets mucked up. Then it's not so clear that there was a crime that was committed under these horrendous circumstances. But I think the prosecutor is just too far down the lane on that they can't turn around now. And as some of the commenters have said, it looks like they're like pulling off or, you know, not totally in it.
It feels like spaghetti on the wall. Like, will this one stick? Let's see if this one does. Another one of their greatest hits that they like to pull out is the term Coleman cooperative. The prosecution put a psychiatrist on the stand who examined Lindsay days after January 24th and said she was Coleman cooperative. That's supposed to prove she wasn't psychotic. But on cross, Reddington, he got the same psychiatrist to admit that a person can can be in psychosis and still appear calm and cooperative and coherent, like this is some sort of mystery. The prosecution's own expert just told this jury that that looking normal doesn't mean you are normal. Does that testimony destroy the prosecution's entire theory? Is the prosecution phoning this in because they know their case makes no medical sense at this point?
Gosh, you know, I just can't help but wonder if they felt sort of pressure in the community to move forward because they have three dead kids. But then, you know, you're trying to put, so what you have is this objective, and then you try to, through a confirmation bias sort of approach, tailor your case to meet that. But it's not adding up, and it's not really following in a logical fashion. And so, you know, I think perhaps they're just trying to show, like, hey, we made the test. There are three dead kids. Did our best, and maybe they know it's a foregone conclusion that it's likely to be not guilty.
Yeah, I mean, the jury heard Reddington read from Lindsay's own journal, the diary. That was another big part of this. Entries she wrote in the weeks before January 24th. I feel like I'm drowning every day. Horrible insomnia and anxiety, which is causing depression. I want to die, written in there. The prosecution says a woman was lucid enough to document her own spiral, was lucid enough to plan three murders. The defense says those words are the spiral, caught on paper in real time. Which side does that journal help?
I think it shows a person who has had an ongoing struggle with severe mental health issues. And it's not just somebody saying that. It's not just a hired gun at the trial who's been paid to say that. This is a historical record. You know, we can see a glimpse into her head and just how chaotic and distressing and confusing that must have been. And I've got to imagine that resonates with the jury. They look at this, they could be transported to where the defendant was when she was writing that, in a sense. And I think, you know, it shows an ongoing mental health thing as opposed to a calm, calculated murder.
At the end of the day, the prosecution here has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was sane. It's not the other way around. And that's a little bit different in Massachusetts. The proof has to come from the state that there was sanity involved. And again, it feels like they're throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what's going to stick to do that. The prosecution has the toxicology. They have the best day. They have the calm hospital exam, but they also have 13 medications, a psych hospital admission 3 weeks out, and a woman in a wheelchair who clearly intended to die that night. Is anything the prosecution has put up enough to prove sanity beyond a reasonable doubt thus far?
I would say absolutely not, in my opinion. I don't think we're even close to that. And you're right that this is a significant wrinkle in the case, in the law, because in a lot of jurisdictions, it's actually the burden of the defense to show mental disease or defect and not being able to tell right from wrong. Here, the prosecution basically has to disprove that. And that's hard to disprove. And so in closing, if I'm defense, I'm like, hey, your jury, you don't have to decide whether she was legally insane. You have to decide if there's a reasonable doubt as to whether she's legally insane. And that's a lower threshold. It's a little easier to get there. And I think that we're much closer to that than we are sanity.
Eric, you've seen the comments on this case. You've been talking about it here. You've been talking it all over the place. I always like the comments because it's interesting. It kind of gives you an idea of like what a jury pool is like out there. Some people very much understand and see the medical end of this, the psychiatric end of this. Some people are hell-bent on not seeing it. And I don't think you're ever going to get some of them there. For whatever reason, it is. It is what it is. It's what they're dealing with. 18 people on this jury. This is not a civil case. So you have to have across the board. Everybody's got to agree. Either she, you know, did this or did not do this, or it's not that she did or didn't, but was she mentally there? Was she responsible for doing this, mentally capable of doing this, or was she basically insane? Where do you see this landing with a jury? Do you see 18 people agreeing in any direction on this case?
At the very least, just in my opinion, how it's been going so far, I think it's going to be not guilty, or at the very least, it's going to be a mistrial in which the jury cannot unanimously come to a guilty verdict. That being said, Tony, so I've talked with several friends about this, including women who are mothers, and some of them see it very differently. They see it as she could have done more to try and protect her family from herself when she had knowledge that she herself was a threat. And she, and in their eyes, she didn't do enough. So I'm just saying, I think reasonable minds could differ on it. And although I see it one way, who knows what's going to happen back in that jury room?
Yeah, I don't know. If I'm a betting person, I think I'm going on a hung jury still. I mean, even in the clear, and I think Reddington's doing a wonderful job. I have all the confidence in him once it's his turn to really take the stage here. But I don't have a lot of confidence in humans. That's where I don't think it's going to end with a clear answer. And then do they do the whole thing over again? Or does the DA just say, you know what? Maybe this shouldn't be prosecuted this way. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts over there. Let's talk about another fine case. Brian Koberger pled guilty to four counts of first-degree murder in the Idaho student killings. He stood in court, told the judge he was guilty, signed a 9-page questionnaire confirming no one forced him, took four life sentences to avoid the death penalty. 13 months later, he filed a handwritten petition claiming his own lawyers scared him into a false confession. Gosh. Don't want to scare Brian. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help us understand Koberger's new claims, his demand for a new trial that he's welcoming, and where this goes, if anywhere. But before we really jump into this, I want to talk about this new board game I see that's coming out. I'm really excited about this. This could be fun for the whole family. And it really, it helps you understand the case more. It helps you understand the law more. And I think it really helps us get to see what's going on in the world of Brian Koberger from behind bars. It's called Brian's Board, the board game. I'd like you to let's take a look before we jump into more discussion of what's going on with the case.
Are you stuck in a tiny concrete box with nothing to do and absolutely no one who believes you? Sounds like you need Brian's Board. The board game, where every spin is a new adventure in maximum security fun. Spin the wheel and see what happens. Land on Call the New York Times. Pick up that phone and explain your innocence. In 47 single-spaced pages. Nobody asked, but here we go. Draw an action card. Politely ask Rufus in cell block 3H to stop urinating in your coffee. Good luck with that one. Tell the mean podcaster to stop making jokes about broomsticks and your orifices. He won't. Read a thesaurus and learn more big words for your next manifesto. Egregious, mendacious, exculpatory. You'll sound almost as smart as you think you are. But watch out for the drop the soap card. If you collect 3, you're out of the game. And the other players? They'll have to identify your remains through dental records alone. Oh, and Steve already called dibs on the teeth. He's making a necklace. Brian's board comes with a spinning wheel. Over 50 action cards, 4 tiny orange jumpsuits, a miniature cell block game board, and 1 very small plastic soap. Plea deal not included. Appeals sold separately. Brian's Board. Fun for the whole cell block.
So happy that, he's doing something. He's doing something behind bars.
I've got a nephew who's got a birthday coming up.
Hey. Holidays aren't far off either. You know, this could be one for everybody.
Right.
Brian Koberger, he stood up in front of that judge. He signed a 9-page questionnaire. Are you entering this plea freely and voluntarily? Yes. Are you admitting to all the elements of the crime? Yes. Do you understand you may not be able to withdraw this plea later? Yes. The judge looked at him and asked directly, are you pleading guilty because you're guilty? Yes. That's layers of prosecution designed to prevent exactly what he is trying to do now. Why does he think none of that matters?
You know, I wonder if when you get in that jailhouse law library or you get access to legal books, your mind, your imagination can really wander and you can start to dream and you could say, hey, this case has one passing similarity to mine. This must be applicable. Oh, I've been wronged. I'm going to actually get out of here. This is, and then you forget about like the reality, the transcript from that plea hearing, the witnesses, the judge, all of that. You know, that's what's going to hold substantial weight, in a courtroom and not, you know, sort of your dreams while you're sitting in that cell.
When you saw the handwritten letter that he sent and that he also typed to the New York Times, and then he sent the one to the court. Now he has a new attorney assigned to him. It wasn't filed by an attorney. It was filed by him after spending time in the law library and writing more notes like a serial killer does. What was your reaction when you saw that? Were you surprised at all that Koberger is trying to pull this? Were you surprised that there's no actual attorney behind that letter? Because no attorney may actually... Would an attorney get behind him signing any of this that's not legally assigned to him by law to be a new representative? What was your take on all of that?
Yeah, you know, it's telling in part that it was not signed off on by an attorney because an attorney is ethically prohibited from making any kind of argument that completely lacks merit, that is not supported by law or fact. And I just wonder if he was asking around and the attorneys were like, bro, like we cannot represent that those things are true. And then he's like, oh, that's okay. I can. I don't have a law license to get revoked, so I'll do it. You have these, I've seen a ton of handwritten stuff like that when I've worked for judges.
Yeah.
And so much of it is devoid of any kind of substance or legal or factual import.
If it wasn't Koberger, we probably wouldn't be talking about it. I mean, how common is this, Eric, that inmates do stunts like this and think that they're going to get somewhere in their infinite boredom behind bars and somehow think, maybe I got a chance here?
Tony, I did what's called a judicial clerkship after law school. It's where you're essentially like a legal advisor to a judge and helping them with stuff. And we would get so many of these letters. And a lot of them, some of them would be very similar in structure and in content, almost as if they sort of got together and they're like, hey, say this. Hey, write this down. Just because, you know, they've got a ton of time in there and they're trying their best to advocate for themselves. But this is way more common than you think. We see these all the time in the judicial system.
Koberger's petition says his lawyers told him and his family, parents, sisters, all in the room, an elaborate story about touring an 8x8 death row cell to scare him into taking the deal. He's using this as an argument that they tried to scare him and his family. He says they told him actual guilt wasn't an important factor. He says he was advised to lie. But every defense attorney in a capital case has the conversation about what execution actually looks like. That's not coercion. That's part of the job. Isn't that just a defense attorney doing their job and Koberger's trying to twist it into something that it's not?
By and large, absolutely. You completely have to convey the reality of the potential consequences to your client. Now, you can never advise them to lie. And if that happened, that's extremely problematic. I haven't heard of any actual evidence of that. But that being said, you got to have a come to Jesus talk sometimes, bro. Like they don't always want to realize, hey, if you don't go down the legally advisable road, it's going to be a gajillion times worse, man. And you don't know this. And I do. And you know, it's their decision ultimately. And you can't engage in undue pressure, but you can impress your point upon them. In fact, I think it's your duty as their counselor.
What would Koberger have to prove to say that any of these points he's trying to make are actually legitimate, other than just this is how it made me feel?
Yeah, you know, he would have to prove a few things. In this context of trying to withdraw a guilty plea, he usually has to prove that his attorneys were constitutionally ineffective, so that their representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, like they were grossly negligent, and that had they not have been so, he would have actually gone to trial in this quadruple homicide death penalty case. So there are a lot to prove. And on that first prong, he's got to show, like, if he can show that they lied to, or that they told him to lie, that might get there. I don't know how in the world he's going to prove that. If he showed that they misled him in some fashion about the law, then that could be getting closer. But I think it's a really high bar, and judges hate to see these motions because they want the finality in the case.
Obviously, there was mountains of evidence against Brian Koberger, his DNA on the knife sheath, his vehicle location data repeatedly, a pattern of all that, his location. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. It, buying the knife, going back online, trying to buy another knife, disassembling his car. It's a huge list of shit. It's not just like one thing over here. And gee, if there's another piece that competes with that, it kind of makes it an even playing field. It's not. But he's treating it like that. And the big argument that is trying to be made, it was made in that broken plea book, not even citing the actual evidence reports, but actually rephrasing things. Hair recovered near Ethan Chapin's hand that the FBI tested and determined was not Koberger. It was described as debris in the actual report itself. He says his lawyers never told him about it, but his own defense expert already examined that hair and concluded it was consistent with Chapin's own hair. And the phrase he uses in the petition, clumps of hair, doesn't appear in any court filing or FBI report. It comes from the book written by someone who says he never spoke to Koberger. Does that help him, or is Koberger borrowing someone else's argument because he doesn't really have one and thought, well, this guy's making a good one for me. A bunch of people out here seem to think it's good because I keep getting these letters from people on the outside. Maybe I should do something with this.
Yeah, constitutionally inadequate investigation can be a part of a meritorious claim to withdraw a guilty plea. But here what it looks like is defense did adequately investigate that. They had their own expert look at it who determined it was a hair consistent with that of the alleged victim, or not alleged anymore, victim. So, I don't think he's going to get much traction there. I imagine his defense counsel made available all the discovery to him. Now, I imagine it's probably, tens of thousands of pages or more, and all of these materials and photos and everything else. And so I don't know that his counsel actually didn't make that available to him. You don't have to sit down and talk through every, 10,000 page discovery packet with the client.
Yeah, and Brian Koberger just saying something aloud doesn't make it fact either or true. Lehigh County Prosecutor Bill Thompson, he's the one who cut the deal over the objections of the Gonzalez family. They wanted a trial. They wanted the death penalty. They called the state of Idaho. They called the state of Idaho and said, "You have failed us." Thompson's argument was that the deal spared the families decades of appeals and guaranteed Koberger would die in prison, that they wouldn't have to deal with him trying to file appeal after appeal or this or that. Obviously, he's filed something and we're talking about him right now. I mean, you can't stop Brian Koberger from speaking aloud. At the end of the day, though, did Thompson fail the families by not knowing that this was a possibility, or did he know that this was a possibility? Not that it will necessarily lead anywhere, but so far it's gotten him a new attorney. So, I mean, that's something, not exactly the spare the families pitch that they were promised.
I certainly understand folks who will say this is the most grave crime we can imagine four times over. So we should seek the gravest consequence the legal system provides, which is the death penalty. I can, of course, see that families, the victim's family, very understandable if that's where they might be. That being said, no, I think that this outcome was the best under the circumstances. You don't know what's going to happen at a jury trial, certainly at a death penalty phase. You look at the Aurora Theater shooting defendant who killed more than James Holmes, killed more than 10 people in my home state of Colorado. Even he didn't get the death penalty. There is no slam dunk in a death penalty case. And to sort of say, hey, we're going to pin this guy on 4 convictions. He's admitting to what he did. He'll be in prison for the rest of his life, most likely. I think that that is the most reasonable course of action.
Is something like this, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're the prosecutor, you're talking about making deals, you're advising the family, the family's giving you their feedback. I mean, the prosecutor's going to do what they're going to do. Is this just kind of one of those things where it's like, yeah, I mean, he can't do this or that traditionally, but you know, you can't stop him from writing a letter to the New York Times or calling them or writing a letter to a judge. Anyone has the possibility to do that. People are going to hear about that, but it doesn't mean it's going to go anywhere. Is there anything that can be said to the family at this point to say or assure them there's no way Brian Koberger is going to go back to trial if that's not what they want to have happen at this point? Or is there, I mean, in your experience here, I guess, percentage-wise, what's the chance that Brian Koberger actually gets a trial because he now says he wants one?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, if I'm the prosecutor, part of that job, part of any legal decision is assessing probabilities. It's trying to forecast, hey, what are the possible consequences? Which one is more likely? Which one is worse? How do I navigate the best possible resolution? I would go to the family as a prosecutor and I would say, hey, look, you look at the probability on this. It is extraordinarily unlikely that he's going to prevail on some sort of pro se motion to withdraw his guilty plea under these circumstances, you know, that this was still the best course of action. I think it's so exceedingly unlikely that he's going to get a new trial on these grounds as we understand them so far.
It'll be fascinating to watch. I just hate expelling more oxygen on Brian Koberger. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Here's another trial that we've been waiting roughly 30 years for. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is going to trial in Las Vegas for the 1996, 30 years ago, murder of Tupac Shakur, nearly 30 years after the shooting. He wasn't caught by forensics or witnesses who flipped. He was caught, prosecutors allege, because he couldn't stop talking about it. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help break down what to expect as the trial for the murder of Tupac actually begins. Keefe D, he wasn't caught by DNA. He wasn't caught by detective work. He allegedly got himself arrested by writing a book. His 2019 memoir, Compton Street Legend, describes being in the white Cadillac, providing the gun and ordering the retaliation hit on Tupac after Tupac's crew beat Davis's nephew at the MGM Grand. He said the same things in a BET documentary. He said the same things in police interviews. Las Vegas Homicide says those public statements were what brought the investigation back to life after sitting cold for decades. Did this man talk himself into the murder charge, Eric?
Yeah, I think absolutely. He's been popping off for years and years and bragging about, oh, being involved in killing the, you know, a beloved artist in so many people's hearts. And so, yeah, that is, he has himself to blame. If he's sitting in that jail cell and wondering, why am I here? It is because he could not keep his mouth shut.
The reason Keefe D. Davis says that he talked, the only reason he told police anything was because he was promised immunity in 2008. It's called a proffer agreement. And remember that term, a proffer deal is where he cooperated with the LAPD on the Biggie Smalls investigation and gave up what he allegedly knew about Tupac's murder in exchange for protection from prosecution. So they were looking for information in the Biggie case. And he said, I can tell you things, but I don't want to be prosecuted for anything I'm about to tell you, but it could help you. He alleges they had that sort of proffer agreement there that said, okay, you're immune from anything that you tell us. Okay, so he talks. His attorneys fought to suppress those statements. The judge let them in. Let's talk about what that first means, Eric, a proffer agreement. Is it a black and white sign here? You're never going to be prosecuted. Is it a gentleman's agreement? What exactly is he talking about?
The term gentleman might be a little generous in some of the scenarios I've been in. But, it can often be very informal. It's kind of like the law enforcement's like, hey, dude, you're screwed on this, and we're going to make it really bad for you. But if you tell us some good stuff that we can use, we'll make it less bad for you. And the person's like, less bad? What does that mean? Like, what are the parameters of this? And so sometimes if I ever have a client do this, I have at least some pillars of the agreement in writing agreed to by both sides, because this is the problem that arises is later on. QPD's like, I thought you said I wouldn't get in trouble for saying this stuff. And then they're like, well, we didn't talk about you saying this stuff outside of this context. And it's all a big confusing mess. And so sometimes it's unclear.
Is it almost, is it relied on sometimes by law enforcement to essentially set someone up and get them to speak more readily by omission of not informing them that, okay, within the context of this conversation, we can't go after you. But if you go on camera, if you go on BET, if you go on Vlad's podcast, if you go on whatever and talk about all of this shit, if you write a book about it, that we can go after you for, even if it's the exact same things you've told us, simply by omitting the fact that you can't go out there and talk about that, we're going to get you for it. But is that even the agreement with every proffer agreement? It seems like a very gray area agreement. That sometimes criminals put a little bit too much faith in of what they can talk about and what they can't talk about, and they don't really seem to understand that there's not really anything set in stone here to begin with.
I am so reluctant every time that this possibility comes up to advise a client to do a proffer for these very reasons that we're talking about, because you just don't know you can't foresee all of the possible contingencies down the road that could come up. And certainly the prosecution has no incentive to say, hey, but we won't prosecute you for X, but if you do Y or Z or A, B, C, D, E, F, then yeah, we will. They don't want to, they're not going to lay all that out. It's not in their interest to do that. And so, yeah, it just becomes very messy. And I think people should be very reluctant about doing it and about the information that comes from it at times.
The prosecution, they're not arguing that QPD pulled the trigger on this 30-year crime now. They say his nephew, Orlando Anderson, is the one who did it, fired the shots from the backseat of that white Cadillac, retaliation for the casino beatdown hours earlier that we all probably have seen the video clip of around the fountain. Anderson denied involvement before he died. He was killed in an unrelated Compton shooting in 1998, so 28 years ago he's been gone. So he can't testify. He can't be cross-examined. The gun has never been recovered. The prosecution's entire theory is that Davis was the shot caller, baller, 20-inch play, Zona Impala. The one who gave the order and supplied the weapon, basically. The alleged shooter dead. So how do you prove the order? And how do you prove he made the order when most of the witnesses are dead and this was 30 years ago? There's no digital trail, just the gangsta brags of QPD out there in social media and wherever he decided to talk.
As a general rule, if you're going to, as the prosecutor, have statements against a defendant, like he was the orchestrator and he did this and he did that, you've got to have the declarants of those statements come into court and say it. And if they are 6 feet underground, that's not happening. So you don't have that evidence, but most likely. And so you've got to have this gamed out in terms of how you're going to get from A to B to C and bring this jury along to have them reach that ultimate conclusion. And if you just have some guy who likes popping off to BET, that might not be enough.
Is it enough, though? I mean, at the end of the day, you go to a jury, you present all this stuff, and I know he's going to try and argue it and fight it, but you got that interview, this interview, that other interview, the book, him constantly saying and bragging about doing this. Why should a jury, for any reason? I mean, this seems like it could be somewhat of a slam dunk because you actually have the defendant saying he did it over and over and over and over. And now suddenly, oops, nope, I thought I was only talking like this for this reason. And now it's not. I mean, how do you think a jury's going to react to that?
I think alleged confessions are some of the most compelling evidence of guilt that we have in a trial. And so, you got to start with that premise that this is going to move a jury. They're going to say, hey, he admitted to this, and not once, not twice, but a bunch of times. And so in jury selection from the defense perspective, you have to kind of prime this jury to say, hey, I know we all think that, like, when a person, we hear that a person may have confessed to something, that must be it, right? Well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about false confessions? Have you thought about ulterior motives? Have you thought about why a person might say they did something that they didn't do, and hope you get a jury receptive to that if you're on the defense side?
Just basically, yes, he said it, but he said it for profit. He did it to self-enrich himself, and you can say he's a shitty person for making up stories that weren't his to make money off of, but at the end of the day, he's not a killer, even though, and you don't have, and their backup to that is a lot of people who could place him where he claims he was are dead. So, yeah, there's a lot of question there. Keefe D placed himself in the Cadillac in his 2008 police proffer. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his BET documentary. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his own memoir and described providing the gun and ordering the hit. Then after his arrest in 2023, he told ABC News he's innocent. I ain't killed nobody, he said. He said he only talked about the murder to make money. He even claimed at one point he wasn't even in Vegas when the shooting happened, contradicting his own book, his own documentary, and his own statements to police. I made it all up for money. Does that work as a defense? Or he didn't make a dime off the proffer? Or did he think that the proffer was the ticket to money because of that? He could then talk after all of this went down.
You know, but put a different way, is there reasonable doubt as to the reliability of his confessions? Is there an alternative, plausible explanation as to why he would do this, that he wanted money, wanted notoriety, that kind of thing? Maybe. And then, you know, one thing you look at, too, is whether his confessions can be objectively corroborated or refuted by other evidence. You know, is there photographic evidence, video evidence, travel plans, receipts, bank statements, things like that could place him in certain places or not? And if we're talking about something that happened 30 years ago, there might not be a ton of corroboration. And so how reliable is that confession?
At the end of the day on this one, I mean, he started talking in 2008 in that proffer agreement, and then he started talking after that in all the places we just talked about. Why did it take all of these years to make an arrest? What's your thought process there? Why now? Why wait all this time to finally go after Keefe D? I mean, why? Oh, well, you finally, the BET documentary, that wasn't enough. The interview over here, that wasn't enough. The book, that wasn't enough. I mean, like, what made the DA finally go, you know what, maybe we should go after this guy because he keeps talking about this?
It's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer. Why now? Why?
Yeah.
Why under these circumstances? And I think those are questions the defense needs to ask the jury rhetorically in closing argument. That, you know, if they really had the goods, you know, things haven't changed significantly in the past 5 years. They could have brought this 5 years ago or longer than that ago. They didn't. They're doing it now for some other reason. And if defense can give a compelling alternative reason why the prosecution might do that, that just further contributes to reasonable doubt, possibly.
I don't know the answer to that question either. I do wonder, and I don't know what the situation is. I haven't dug into this, but obviously we do see a lot of situations where we go, why are they prosecuting this right now? And you go, oh, someone's up for election and they want to have that in their little commercial, like, I'm the one who put so-and-so away for the murder of so-and-so. I can't say that's what's going on, but we do see it quite a bit. I just don't know the answer to that question. Anyway, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will follow this trial as it gets underway 30 years late. All right. Until next time. For Eric, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.